The WBAI Community Advisory Board, CAB, will meet from 1 to 3 p.m. in the public lobby of the Deutsche Bank building located at 60 Wall Street in Lower Manhattan. The CAB is a volunteer group of interested listeners who meet monthly to gather public comments and ideas on WBAI programming and policies. All listeners are welcome and encouraged to make the effort to attend this Sunday, January 21st at 1 p.m. in the atrium at 60 Wall Street.
On Monday, January 22nd, the Incorporated Village of Hempstead, in conjunction with the National Action Network Nassau County Chapter, CAYV, Hope for Change, and the NAACP's Hempstead branch will be presenting the second installment of its school-to-prison pipeline farm at Kennedy Memorial Park, located at 335 Greenwich Street in Hempstead. The forum starts at 7 p.m. and is free. For more information, contact Dr. David Gates at telephone 516-478-6436.
The ENJAN and the New Jim Crow Action Network meets in Kingston on Monday, January 22nd from 6 to 8 p.m. at the New Progressive Baptist Church at 8 Hone Street in Kingston, and in Poughkeepsie on Wednesday, January 24th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the Sadie Peterson Delaney African Roots Library, Family Partnership Center, located at 29 North Hamilton Street in Poughkeepsie. For more information on both meetings, go to enjan.org or call 845-475-8781. This has been your WBAI Community Bulletin Board. If you have an event you would like us to announce, send it 2 weeks in advance to cbb at wbai.org.
And the time is just about 8 p.m. on a Wednesday evening. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. And it's just about time for another exciting edition of Off the Hook. A very good evening to you. The program is Off the Hook. We're Lean Studio tonight. Rob T. Firefly here with you, and I am joined by Voltaire.
Good evening.
And we'll have a guest joining the two of us in a moment, but of course there's so much going on. A lot happened this past week or so, and we're going to talk about Hawaii. For those of you who may not know, a little something interesting happened in Hawaii this past Saturday at around 8:07 local time. People in Hawaii found themselves the recipient of warnings on their mobile phones, emergency alerts of the type that you only are meant to get in emergencies. This alert warned the citizens of Hawaii, and I'm going to read this verbatim. Emergency alert. Ballistic missile threat inbound to Hawaii. Seek immediate shelter. This is not a drill.
For our listeners, I'd like to remind them that this is a drill, actually.
Yeah, this actually is a drill. If you're listening to us in Hawaii, you've already had enough aggravation. We're not here to bring you more, but we're here to talk about things. And So this happened, and of course, there was not actually a missile threat inbound to Hawaii. We were not playing global thermonuclear war, but what was actually happening was the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency was doing one of their routine tests. They're supposed to test the emergency alert system that they have there. And this is done, apparently one of the steps of this process, and this came out afterward, is selecting what you want to do from a pull-down menu. And there are multiple options on this pull-down menu. One of them is to test the system. One is to actually use the system to send out a real alert. In this case, the operator selected the wrong menu option, according to HEMA spokesman Richard Raposa in an article in the Washington Post on Sunday. So this raised a lot of questions among the people in the sort of communications world who are interested in not only how these alerts are set up to go out, but what kind of fail-safes are in place. And this has been our first real taste, I think, on a big scale of being shown that maybe not enough fail-safes were in place at the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency. But we've to talk about this with us, we are joined by Trey Forgety. Am I pronouncing that correctly, Trey?
You got it.
Excellent. And could you tell us a little bit about who you are and why we're speaking to you about emergency alerts?
Sure. I'm Director of Government Affairs at the National Emergency Number Association, or as we like to call it, the 911 Association. I'm also Director of Information Security Issues, so it's my job to know a few things about how emergency systems work across the U.S. and Canada, and also how we can better protect those and better make sure that they work the way they're supposed to when they're supposed to.
And in this case, they sort of didn't work when they were supposed to.
Well, the good news is that for the most part, the system actually did work the way it was intended. When someone selected, send a ballistic missile alert, a ballistic missile alert was sent to the majority of the people that should have received it. So that's the good news. The system actually worked in that regard. Now, the one part of the system that seems to have broken down are the fail-safes that exist to prevent false alerts. False alerts are not a good thing because the public comes to not rely on alerts if they see a lot of false alerts, and so we work very hard to prevent that.
Of course.
In this case, for a couple of reasons, that didn't happen.
Now, false alerts are a concern. Actually, it's funny. It's funny this comes up because only last night, someone I know of, I think, who listens to the show, had a carbon monoxide detector go off in their home, and were able to get out and safely evacuate their household. But as he mentioned when I was communicating with him about this, his first reaction was annoyance because we've evolved to a point where we hear alarms all the time, car alarms and things like that, and the immediate response now is to just get aggravated by it, kind of ignore it, hope someone takes care of it. But this is a system in which we are meant to have a big degree of faith, and for very good reasons. So, what actually went wrong in the equation this time was it just the human part of the equation?
So, I think there are really two parts of the equation that went wrong here. First is an issue that's been around for a long time. Public safety systems, software in particular, are very low volume, mostly proprietary systems. There's not a lot of money to be made in selling them. And so as a result of that, they've suffered a chronic lack of quality user interface and user experience design. In this case, it was really easy to click the wrong alert. Now, we have processes in place to prevent that. Folks are supposed to double-check their work and make sure they've clicked the right thing before they send an alert. In some places, it actually takes two people to originate an alert. But in this case, you had both of those pieces that went wrong at the same time, and unfortunately, those cross-checks, the user interface and the double-checking rules, didn't work out in our favor, and we didn't stop an incorrect alert.
Great. People, listeners to the program may be familiar with the whole two keys thing from the docudrama War Games, where we had a couple of soldiers, and they each had their own key, and they had to turn it at the same time. But in this case, it was, and this screenshots of this were going around among the members of the community familiar with user interface issues, user design issues, UX, and saying this is maybe something that's more important to put than to just throw in two options of a pull-down menu like this that are very close together. But so what factors go into sort of designing a system like this to help prevent the sorts of things that we've just seen happen?
So there are two critical components of this. First, you have to strike the right balance between the ability to easily or quickly originate alerts when you need to, and the ability to make sure that alerts are reliably not sent when you don't need to. So that's the first factor that interface designers and system designers, because it goes beyond the software, have to worry about. The second thing is whether you implement multi-person control, and that goes to the same balance. Sometimes you'll have two people around. Sometimes you won't. Maintaining that's very expensive for local governments and state governments, and so it doesn't always happen.
So, in your work, how do you deal with issues like this when you're presented with them?
So, my work is primarily on the 911 side. So we work with the inbound call systems, mm-hmm. but they suffer from all of the same issues that the alert origination software does. Again, lack of quality UI and UX design, low volume, so it's hard to get changes like that made, and a lot of ingrained work practices that mean it's difficult to push through a change in a user interface, even if you know that you need it. So a lot of our work focuses on the change management process and the ability to introduce new software with new features like these in a way that is not disruptive to the workflow, but nonetheless still adds critical new features like the ability to prevent someone from doing something you don't want them to do by accident.
And mentioning the sort of emergency number systems and 911 and things like that, there was a story in the, see if I can pull it up here, a story in the Wall Street Journal recently asking the question, why can Uber find you but 911 can't? And that goes into issues like we all have these apps on our phones now, or most of us do, where you can pinpoint your location to a service that is sending you a car or a pizza or things like that. But yet 911 operators and systems seem to be working a generation behind in the technology sense. Is this something you find to be the case?
So the reality is the 911 systems don't have control over what location data they receive. That ultimately comes down to choices made by wireless carriers. And the carriers have several choices between older network-based technologies, newer handset-based technologies, and a variety of emerging systems like Metropolitan Beacon Systems and the National Emergency Address Database, which will be a system of Wi-Fi and Bluetooth access points that are at known locations. So let's say I register my access point with my home address. That can make it easier for the system to determine my location if I'm at home. But all of those changes on the 911 side, we're simply recipients of that data. When we request location, we get the best thing that the carrier has.
Right. And, of course, obviously with these other smartphone apps, you're granting these other companies and entities permission to use the GPS tracking functionality on your own device versus trying to rely on any existing infrastructure to send along this information on the technical side of things.
That's true, though we are privileged in the 911 space that during an actual 911 call, we can get access to any location data that the carrier is able to and has chosen to take from the user's device. So we can actually, the handset software actually automatically overrides location privacy for purposes of a 911 call on the understanding that, look, if you're making a 911 call, you probably want to be found so that you can be helped.
Do you have access to people's IP address if they're connected over Wi-Fi?
Generally, no. For the most part, because making a 911 call if you're connected over Wi-Fi, for example, is usually either a VoIP call or Wi-Fi calling through your carrier, which is a flavor of a VoIP call. But typically speaking, we can't get that automatically in today's 911 systems. We are working towards systems in the future where you can get that automatically, and there are processes in place so that 911 systems can contact a carrier to get an IP address.
Interesting. Where do you see this going in the future? Do you see us learning from what happened in Hawaii and taking immediate steps to address these things, or do you see these things remaining sort of vulnerable and uncared for more than they should be?
So the user interface and user experience design issues are always going to plague public safety so long as we use one-off, expensive, rare systems. But we've learned some things already that can help. So from just the Hawaii system issues, they're starting to add canned false alarm messages that can be quickly pushed out if a false alarm is accidentally initiated. And on the broader 911 side, we're actually moving the nation toward an all-IP next-generation 911 system that supports not just legacy voice, but also video and text and data and pictures that can really enrich the ability of responders to provide services in an emergency.
Now, how is the telecom industry working with you on this? Because we're seeing things like lobbyists from the telecom industry basically putting off the adoption of newer technologies or newer rules, kicking these things forward. If I can find the story here, there was a piece of legislation that wanted to, in September 2016, these rules were enacted by the FCC, not legislation, FCC rules, which required telecom companies to increase their maximum message length of these emergency messages from 90 to 360 characters, to allow for clickable links to phone numbers and websites, to send pictures or videos. These were enacted in 2016, but due to lobbying by Verizon and by the wireless telecom trade group CTIA, this specific regulation has been kicked forward and it does not go into effect until March 2019, which is about 30 months after the regulations were adopted.
So, in the world of telecom, that's actually relatively quick. So our organization works very closely with all parts of the industry. So the public sector, the 911 centers, the carriers, equipment vendors, and more recently, a lot of very innovative sort of software providers who aren't really part of the traditional telecom infrastructure. But I'll tell you this, with the tens of thousands of cell sites that there are around the country and the millions of older telephone devices that are out there, handsets, that you sometimes have to wait for turnover on, advancing a system that has to be universal like WIA, like Next Generation 911, isn't always as fast as you could want, even in the public safety sector, sometimes for really good technical reasons and other times not necessarily.
So when it comes to, you talked about how the procurement process with these things are very small because, or very slow because you have such few people that buy the software and the state government don't have a lot of money. It's something that your organization is working on. When you're advancing this procurement software, are you interested in making sure that the software itself is open source, or is that just not part of the purview at the moment?
So there have been a few different open source efforts in the public safety community over the past several years. Unfortunately, there hasn't been a really fast adoption of open source software in the public safety community, in part because requirements vary so much. Every single county, town, jurisdiction historically has had the ability to procure one-off systems for their emergency service software, so things like computer-aided dispatching and 911 call taking. And the result of that has been there hasn't been a large enough community around open source software to successfully produce products in the space.
Would it be possible for them to demand that any contracted software is open source, or is that more of a collective action problem where you have so many small actors that they don't have bargaining power?
I think it would be a very complex sort of thing, in part because some governments have policies around contracting that would complicate the use of open source, and in part because it's not clear that there is market space for that. In other words, that there are developers out there who would invest in these, you know, low-volume products if they knew they had an open source requirement.
I see.
So how might members of the open source community in particular who would like to contribute to things like this, are there channels for them to go about this at present?
That's a great question. There absolutely are ways for open source developers and folks in the free software community to get involved. So if you take a look at the main standard for next generation 911, it's published by our organization. It's called the I3 standard. It's based almost entirely on IETF standards track protocols and data structures. And the great thing about that is that it means that we need reference implementations, and in many cases, preferably open source reference implementations, to advance that standards work. And so there's all kinds of things, location information servers and emergency call routing, emergency services routing proxies, and so on, that all need to be developed. And having an open source option out there is kind of a really cool product that, or process that I don't think anyone has really tackled yet.
Interesting. Well, this is certainly a lot for all of us to think about, and we've enjoyed speaking about this with you, Trey Forgety. Where might people find you online and be able to learn more about what you do?
You can check out our organization at www.nena, that's N-E-N-A, .org, or you can reach me on Twitter at tforgety.
Excellent. Trey, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Excellent. Have a good night. Well, certainly a lot for all of us to think about there. And, yeah, a lot for Hawaii to think about while they're decompressing. One other fun aspect of this story that I'd like to mention. Warning point two. Is that currently the password to anything that you've got going on? I mean, I shouldn't ask you this on the
Hold on, let me change it and then answer that.
Okay, only because I noticed that Post-it stuck to the monitor of your laptop there, and I just wanted. Oh wait, that's not your Post-it. That's from the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency, who in an Associated Press photo taken in July, which has since been making the rounds after this Hawaii story. In this photo, you can see you know, an employee and some of the cool computer screens that they've got around, and you know, big clocks up on the wall showing the time in different areas and things, but there's also a Post-it stuck to one of the computer monitors. And zooming in on the photo, you can see that it says password warning point two. So let's hope they've changed it by now. If they haven't changed it already, they probably should. Anyway, a lot of other stuff going on. Let's talk a little bit about some news that we had this past weekend at the Hope Conference, that little hacker do that we like to throw every couple of years.
Did it happen already?
In Midtown Manhattan. Oh, it didn't. No, the conference didn't happen already. No, that happens in July, this July 20th through 22nd in the Hotel Pennsylvania in Midtown Manhattan. But what did happen is we opened up the ticket sales, and they are going briskly. We had put up some early bird batches of tickets earlier, and they went within seconds. But now there's a large batch of tickets available. They're still up. You can find them at hope.net or in the 2600 store. But also, we have put up the call for participation, the call for papers, the call for people who wish to speak at the conference, share things that they're into from all sorts of hacker-type subjects. Whether they're the sorts of things you might expect at a hacker conference or might not expect at a hacker conference. At the end of the day, the conference is there for the talks, for the speakers, and we've been doing this for many years now and have had the most amazing things presented from members of the community, from things like hard security and hardware, software, things like that you would expect. There are also political talks. There are also talks on there have been talks on food. There have been talks on human sexual relationships. There have been talks on I think caffeine and all sorts of cool things. I mean, really, really, the sky's the limit. And you can apply the hacker mindset and the hacker curiosity to just about any subject that is important to you in your life. So, if you would like to speak at the Circle of Hope, which is what we're calling our 12th conference, then go to hope.net. And click on the speakers link, and all the tips for submission are there for you. Some examples of subjects we've had in the past, some info on how you might like to frame your presentation, prepare it for us, and then those of us on the Hope Speaker Committee will start going through them and talking about which ones would be nice to have. So get in touch with us as soon as you're able, hope.net. and you can get all that info there. You can also register for the conference. As I said, there's information on the venue, on traveling, on the code of conduct, all sorts of good stuff. Hope.net, or if you're being fancy, xii.hope.net. XII, of course, being the Roman numeral for 12. They're not letters, they're a numeral. So that's some cool stuff going on. I'd also like to talk a bit about our premiums here at WBAI, where we've got an update on that situation. We've started hearing from listeners who have been letting us know that they've been receiving their paintings that I did for the most recent pledge drives, the most recent couple of pledge drives with historic data storage devices, and I've heard back from some people. I've seen some photos of the paintings on display in people's homes, and that's a big thrill. But there's something else that happened with this. We've also heard from one or two listeners who have not yet received their paintings. So keep the faith. They're probably on their way to you, but there is a complication. A complication about which we must be open with you, our supporters and listeners. And the complication is that due to a mishap here at the station, they actually committed to sending out a few more paintings than I had committed to give them. And so the limit that I gave the station was accidentally not honored to the tune of a few extra paintings. So that is fine. I am working on those, but there's a chance that the first batch of paintings, all the paintings that I had committed to, have gone out. They should be on the way to their new homes, but there are some that are going to take a little longer because I've got to make them and then send them out express, because those are going to homes that have waited far too long for them. But transparency is key. So thank you to everyone who has gotten in touch with us with the info that they've received things, that they haven't received things. If you're still waiting on stuff, like I said, you might get your paintings within the next week or so. But if you don't, get in touch with us, oth@2600.com, and we will work out who has gotten theirs, who hasn't, and we will make it right. Meanwhile, a couple other listener emails. Mary writes into us. Okay, this is interesting. Mary writes, I sent in an inquiry to my local listserv asking who do I contact to get the old phone boxes I don't use off my house. I'm having work done, and they dangle along with the wires hanging off the house, and neither cable nor contractors can or will touch them. For some reason, a responder sent me to your website, though it looks like a radio program and not someone with info on who I call to deal with the superfluous obsolete phone boxes. But if you have any clue, I'd appreciate it. Thanks so much. And if she doesn't know we're a radio show, she might not be listening now for her answer.
She can find us as a podcast.
Well, that's true. So if you're not listening to us right now on the air, you can listen to us later as a podcast. So go ahead and prepare to do that. But Mary, what can we tell Mary? If she's got phone boxes hanging off the side of her house that she does not want, I would imagine it's the responsibility of whatever entity put the boxes there. Chances are it's an entity that no longer exists under that name, because the telephone company in the landline era in this state has changed names and controllers and things a number of times. But I think it probably, if it's a telephone box, it probably leads to the company now known as Verizon. So I would recommend getting in touch with them. So maybe I'll write that up to her in text as well, on the off chance that she's not listening to us right now, which is kind of inconsiderate. A lot of other stuff going on this week. There's been endless debate here at the station over a word used by the president, which we cannot say. In fact, there's a poster up on the wall, and it definitely contains part of that word, so we cannot say it. We're not going to, because even if we could get away with it, we like to keep things. This is a family show, basically.
Yeah, I don't think we could afford the fine at this point.
Yeah, the FCC already has us on their blank list, I think. But talking of this word, it's very interesting, because it made waves around the net, as these things do. There are stories of it being projected on Trump's own hotels and properties with video projectors or image projectors. There are stories of it being used in coordinated efforts to fill the Yelp reviews of Trump's hotels and Mar-a-Lago and other properties. So I think it seems kind of appropriate. I mean, I must admit I've not stayed at one of his establishments, but I'm willing to bet that maybe it would apply somehow. But yeah, that's going on and raising a lot of interesting questions about who can say things, who can't. Cable news, I think, was the first to break the taboo and use it openly, because of course they're not subject to FCC regulations, not being broadcast entities in the over-the-air analog sense. Although no one's over-the-air analog anymore, it's all digital. But in the over-the-air sense, those are the stations subject to FCC rules, such as us here at WBAI, such as your local network TV stations that you could still get with a plain old antenna rather than a cable box. But broadcast media has been sneaking it in here and there, with many warnings and in news settings. So it's interesting to see where this particular bit of discourse is taking. I guess how these regulations are applied. Does obscenity, or what is generally thought of as obscenity, not count as obscene when the president does it? If when the president does it, it's not obscene. That sounds a bit Nixon-y, but maybe I should just leave that where it is. Meanwhile, other things going on. Talking of politicians, Chelsea Manning.
She has my vote.
she has your vote for United States Senator of Maryland, which is important. I guess if you need help moving so you can live there by the time the election happens, I'll help you you lift your furniture. But Chelsea Manning has filed to run for U.S. Senate in Maryland. She is now a political candidate. Chelsea, of course, the former Army soldier who was convicted of leaking classified data to WikiLeaks, who got out on a sort of pardon, and has gone on to become a major activist and all sorts of things, is challenging Democrat incumbent Benjamin L. Cardin, who is in his second term in the Maryland Senate and up for re-election in November. The primary happens in late June. The election proper will happen in November. And it's very interesting. She's not said very many specific things, I don't think, yet about why she's chosen to run. But it's definitely interesting, I think, with a capital I, that she's doing this. And we will be keeping an eye on her and seeing where this goes.
And it's been kind of fun watching the Democrat establishment come out of the woodwork and accuse her of being a Russian bot and stuff like that, or Russian agent. And they wasted no time doing that.
So. Yeah, absolutely. The sorts of immediate character assassination that goes on in these situations, it's kind of fascinating to behold. And like, it's like watching a supernova happen. You know what's happening. You know that everything's, you know, gonna basically make a big mess, but you can't turn away.
Yeah.
So if any listeners of ours are in Maryland and have particular feelings about this, get in touch. Send us email oth@2600.com, or send tweets at us at Hacker Radio Show, and we'll see where this goes. Last week we reported on Kodak, the company that used to make the camera things, what spit out bits of paper. They got into the crypto world, or the cryptocurrency world, or the blockchain world, and announced their own cryptocurrency at CES. And there wasn't much info about it yet, but of course, since they said blockchain out loud, that drove their stock up and got people talking about them. And this story turns out to be even weirder than anyone had thought at the time. A story on Gizmodo is talking about how They'd announced that they were forming their own cryptocurrency called Kodak Coin, which, you know, what name do you think came in second? But as happened next, the blockchain that they've got, their Kodak Coin blockchain, will contain the blockchain-powered Kodak One rights management platform. So some sort of digital rights management attached to a blockchain generated by the company Kodak. And it gets even weirder than that, because they also, on a completely different line, announced that they are going to be renting out Bitcoin miners. Bitcoin miners, for those unfamiliar, are tiny computers basically dedicated to churning out new Bitcoin, and it's something that used to be vastly profitable. Today is far less so. But Kodak wants to rent you out a Bitcoin miner for the low, low price of $3,400 US, and upfront. And then over the course of 2 years, you'll have this thing chugging away on your electricity and connectivity, and Kodak will get half the Bitcoin it generates, which Kodak claims that if Bitcoin averages $14,000 for a Bitcoin for the next 2 years, the miners will generate $25 a day or $700 a month, of which the client would get $375. So if you're looking to spend $3,400 to pull down $375 a month, or what might be that, depending on, you know, the price of Bitcoin not fluctuating, which we know it does every day in all directions. So, you know, the reaction to this has been interesting. A columnist on How To Geek called it the dumbest... Oh, there's that word again. I'll just say the dumbest blank I've ever seen at CES. A researcher called Nicholas Weaver noted that the cost estimates are insanely wrong. Assumes no increases in mining rate or power cost. So basically, this is looking like a big box of hope and dreams and maybe, you know, weirdness that won't exactly deliver on its promises. But it's Kodak. It's the company that used to smear chemicals on paper so that you could see things on them. And it's just fascinating to watch them go. Some years ago, Cory Doctorow, the speculative fiction writer, wrote a book called Makers, in which, in this book's fictional world, Kodak had and Duracell had basically mutually decided that their business models were obsolete, and so chose to merge and call themselves Kodacell and make 3D printers and all sorts of other stuff. And this, you know, I thought that was pretty weird when I read the book, but, you know, truth is stranger than fiction. You could not make this blank up. And...
We should also note that we had Cory Doctorow on the show to discuss this.
Yes, we did. We did have Cory Doctorow on the show to discuss the book Makers. Much later, we had Cory Doctorow as a keynote at Hope after trying to do so for years. By the way, Hope, you can get the info on that at hope.net or HopeConf on Twitter. We're rather excited about that. What's going on in the rest of the world? The UK. There is an interesting story coming out of the UK where there will be new laws coming into force in April, which will mean compulsory ID checks on all porn sites. Talking about digital strangeness, so the UK is going to... There have been shades and threats of the UK trying to do various things to regulate online pornography. This latest bit is apparently going to try and legislate that all porn sites operating in the UK should have the users' ID cards on file to prove that they're old enough to be looking at what they're looking at. So this, of course, is really interesting privacy-wise. I mean, the users of the site, these sorts of sites, are probably one of the most private things about them that they would not want other entities to have record of. This new system will be apparently policed by the British Board of Film Censorship, whose day job is basically what it says on the tin. They are the ratings equivalent to, say, the Motion Picture Association of America, who decide what's safe and what's not.
The MPAA here is a private organization, whereas over there it's actually tied to the government.
Right, that's an important distinction. They're actually... an official agency rather than a private org like the MPAA. So the online ID checks will mean people have to prove they're 18 before viewing any porn online and are part of the Digital Economy Act 2018. This comes from a story on UK's Yahoo News site. This seems to open up so many cans of worms, not in the least because not every adult site is one that you have to use forms of payment for, so the possibility existed that you could use them somewhat anonymously as these things go, but it looks like the British government does not like that and is going to try and quash it. So we'll see what happens with this. And if you're affected by this, if you're in the UK, or if you're in the industry, or if you're just like, if you just have feelings about this, let us know, oth@2600.com. But the...
Do you think you'll need to show a credit card to be able to get a goat seed?
And that's a thing, too, is that you can find yourself looking at things online that you didn't mean to, because that's the way the net works. You type the wrong thing, or you look at the wrong thing, and suddenly something you maybe weren't specifically looking for is shown to you. Like say the Rick Astley video or things of that sort. But what are the legal possibilities of this sort of thing now? Anyway, more on this as it develops, and we will keep looking at this. What else is going on in the world, Voltaire?
We have some updates on the Section 702 amendment that's going through the House and Senate, which would it basically gives NSA carte blanche to surveil, conduct surveillance without warrants. So last we checked, it was about to go through the House. There was an amendment to make it more amenable to privacy, and it failed, sadly. But the good news is that the majority of Democrats voted in favor of the reform amendment, which is a change from the past when they would have been too worried about being soft on terror. And it kind of shows how the momentum, even though like bad stuff, bad laws are still being passed now with surveillance, it's the momentum since Snowden has been towards reform. And then in the Senate, there were there's this filibuster by 5 senators, 3 Democrats and 2 Republicans. And that, the filibuster was overturned by a vote of 60. Unfortunately, a lot of the, in both houses of Congress, though, a lot of the leadership, such as Nancy Pelosi, voted for the surveillance and against the reform. But in the positive development is that all the people that are prospective Democrat presidential candidates, such as Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and even like traditionally conservative people like Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, who actually used to be a prosecutor and like thus very like quote unquote tough on crime, they all voted against. They voted against the passage of the bill, or voted against the closure, so against surveillance. So I think that's a good sign that the direction is towards surveillance reform.
Yeah, but although, of course, this has not been by any means along party lines, this debate, there was the information went around last night that the deciding vote on cutting off debate for privacy amendments to the NSA spying bill was cast by Claire McCaskill, Democratic senator from Missouri, who later went on to tweet about, who had just tweeted about how much of an honor it was to march with a bunch of African-Americans to celebrate Martin Luther King Day in St. Louis.
Good thing he was never surveilled on it.
Yeah, right before helping to move along measures to really, to warrantlessly surveil American citizens, just as was shamefully done to Dr. King.
It's really gross how many so-called hashtag resistance people are voted for this the surveillance to continue. Mm-hmm. And they handed Trump the ability to have an even stronger surveillance state.
Yeah. Well, today Claire McCaskill is tweeting about how she has the flu, so maybe that explains her vote.
Karma.
Yesterday. Perhaps, but
karma is something I cannot say on the air.
Or indeed. So. Yep, this continues to be a major problem in both sides of the political spectrum and everywhere in between.
We should also say, even though the filibuster was stopped, there's still a chance to stop it in the Senate. So go to act.eff.org and find out how to contact your senator, tell them to vote against this.
Exactly, eff.org, and we'll see where this goes and how much hope we might have left. Some other fun things going around. We had the company XBT. The company XBT is selling their domain name. They're a tech firm that was referred to in material published by BuzzFeed in the, what is it called? the dossier detailing, you know, Fusion GPS is what it's called. The Fusion GPS dossier compiled by a research firm called Fusion GPS, which contained info on allegedly agencies that were hacking the DNC, that were, you know, doing what at whose behest, and XBT was named in this. So basically they are finding themselves not very popular in the tech world and have resorted to selling their domain name, which is xbt.com. And XBT just happens to be a common abbreviation for Bitcoin. So they're auctioning it off for Bitcoins.
It's only 20 Bitcoins, which is pretty cheap right now. So.
Well, actually, they've set the minimum price at 200 Bitcoins.
Oh, okay.
And which, as of today, according to Bloomberg Technology, is about $2.9 million worth. So we'll see where this goes. It looks like they're looking to cryptocurrency cut and run, which I can't say I actually blame them all that much. I mean, they're probably, you know, it would probably cost at least that much in PR to get their goodwill back if they had any.
Yeah, and they really lucked out because they started the business before Bitcoin became such a big thing, and it's just a coincidence that they chose the acronym XBT.
Yeah, that was just a sheer coincidence. They happened to own what became a desirable acronym. But moving on to let's have some good news. Let's have some news that'll maybe lift your spirits a bit about terrible things that are going on in the world that seem unstoppable. Our own Attorney General, New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, had announced late last year his intentions to do this. Today did it. Filed suit to stop illegal rollback of net neutrality. AG.ny.gov is the site of the Office of the Attorney General, and this is a press release there. The long and the short of it is Attorney General Eric T. Schneiderman led a coalition of 22 attorneys general in filing a multi-state lawsuit to block the FCC's illegal rollback of net neutrality. The coalition filed a petition for review in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, formally commencing the lawsuit against the FCC and the federal government. You can read the petition on the Attorney General's site. Interesting to note all the attorneys general from states all over the country that joined in on this. The lawsuit is led by Attorney General Schneiderman and filed by the attorneys general of New York, California, Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Illinois, Iowa, Kentucky, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Mississippi, New Mexico, North Carolina, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Vermont, Virginia, Washington, and Washington, D.C. So, 22 attorneys general, that's almost half the attorneys general in the country, have all thrown in together on this. And that makes this a really interesting lawsuit, one which hopes to roll back the efforts by Ajit Pai's FCC under the Trump administration to kill net neutrality dead, finally, after many administrations had tried to roll it back in the past. So, yeah, keep an eye on this, ag.my.gov, to keep an eye on what Attorney General Schneiderman's up to. And maybe contact your own state's attorney general. If you're in New York, say thanks. If you're in one of these other states that are thrown in on this, say thanks. If you're in a state that hasn't, maybe ask your attorney general if they might be interested in joining in, because this is a very interesting occasion and a bit of a fun attorney general party. I mean, we need to let them out and romp and frolic among their own kind for, you know. Like when you take your dog to the dog park, you've got to let your attorney general maybe throw in on a massive attorney general fun time lawsuit.
Yeah, and the fact that there are almost half the state attorney generals are signed on to this is really going to put weight on the judges when they make a decision. Like, a lot of people like to think that, oh, judges are totally impartial to politics and they don't care about public opinion, they just care about the law. In fact, they overwhelmingly do, and if there's lots of people in power or lots of people in the public that have a strong opinion, they'll take that into account.
Right. Well, we'll keep an eye on this. And I think we've got a little bit of time left. Maybe we could see if we could get some phone calls coming in. We can hear from some of our dear listeners out there. So if you would like to give us a call, that number is 347-335-0818. And you can reach us on the air and tell us what's on your mind, whether it's about something we've been talking about, something else you'd like to speak your mind about. Give us a call, 347-335-0818.
And if you have comments or questions, you can tweet at us at Hacker Radio Show.
You can indeed. So while we wait for those to start rolling in, what else is going on in the world? Here's another fun story about politicians trying to do the right thing. U.S. Senators Elizabeth Warren, Democrat from Massachusetts, and Mark Warner, Democrat from Virginia, have introduced the Data Breach Prevention and Compensation Act to hold large credit reporting agencies like Equifax accountable for data breaches. And we've talked about the Equifax breach a lot, so has every other news outlet in the country. But this is maybe a step toward holding agencies accountable for screwing up in that manner. We'll keep an eye on that. You can find Senator Elizabeth Warren's post on Medium.com to learn more about this. In the meantime, it looks like we've got a phone call. Caller, are you there? Hello?
That's one time I'm not listening. You can go on and hear me.
Speak up, please. Hello?
Yeah, what's up? How you doing? Okay. I got a question. I had remember seeing it here and listening to y'all years ago. Matthew, let me go in the room and turn the other radio down because it's echo. Real quick.
Yeah, we like listening to our own voices, but not that much.
Yeah, okay. So check it out. This is what I wanted to ask you.
What's up?
I remember one time y'all just said the TVs, when they came, they had the technology that they could see you or they can listen to you or something, but and then you listened and you said which TVs. I think it was like two or three of them that did not do that, and they had the capability. Mm-hmm. But when you bought it, it was disengaged, and you would have to engage it. The other ones, it was actually engaged. And how many people even know that? And that was a couple few years ago, but I'm just thinking about that, and I'm just wondering, like an update on that now, on which TVs, you know, and even maybe, well, I don't know about laptops, because I pretty much buy Apple, but well, that's what I'm really specifically concerned with, that Apple product, Samsung, mm-hmm. my laptop. Like, if there's something engaged where people can watch you, you know, and or hack into it, or do their products come disengaged, and I would have to engage it.
Right. So, we mentioned this. There was a story about a specific television manufacturer. I don't remember which one off the top of my head.
I believe it was Samsung.
I think it might have been Samsung. I think you're right, Voltaire. That had actually microphone capability and was monitoring users the audio in users' rooms in some way collecting that data or sending it back to Samsung and basically TV watching you instead of the other way around, which is how it's supposed to be. And I don't believe there have been any major updates in this sort of situation except that smart TVs, which are the kind of TVs that are basically computers.
And they're the only ones you can buy now.
Are the only ones you can buy now. You used to be able to just buy a TV that would simply do its job, decoding video signals, showing them to you, and that was it. But every TV now has other functionality, has computer functionality on board to do things like let you watch online video services or play games or do whatever, but this comes at a cost. So smart TVs.
So, but even if that was so, I'm just saying, even the way, is there a way we could push back and say, okay, God, fine, it's a smart TV, but however, mm-hmm. That's something that I don't want. In other words, so then we could, let's just say, hypothetically, we would be able to make them, or at least some of the carriers would say, yeah, this is the principle, we don't have five. We put the capability in, however, mm-hmm. we don't sell it engaged. But on page, let's say, of the big, thick booklet that no one ever reads, mm-hmm. but let's say page 154, it tells you how to engage this
right.
if you wanted to. So that's something that, you know what I mean? So because I think we buy a smart TV, that's where the technology is. It's not mm-hmm. like it should have to be a given that it can listen to us
right.
or, you know, invade our privacy. You know, I think even under the privacy laws, isn't there some room for us to be able to try to, you know, correct that?
One would hope. I mean, I would say the only real choice a consumer who wants to go buy a new television from a store now would have is to find out first, will this TV work offline? Will this TV work if you don't hook it to the internet, if you don't hook it to your Wi-Fi, if you don't hook it to your router? Because, of course, if you don't do that, you won't be able to watch internet stuff on it like your Netflix or your Amazon or what have you. But But if your television is not connected to the internet, it can't send data over the internet. So if you have it set up, if you have it only connected to, say, your video devices, your video players, or your cable box, or what have you, then you might have a chance there. But I think that is a question that's between you and your television dealer. So it's going to be interesting to see how long we can get televisions that will still be televisions if you don't hook them up to the damn net.
Right. Because I have a TV where it's a Sharp. I'm only drawing a blank because I'm on the phone with it, but and basically I have Netflix and all that on it.
Yeah.
But this one's been a couple of years, so it's not the latest smart TV. I think it may have been the first version of smart TVs. It's pretty thin, but now the newer one's even thinner.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that I can go through the settings in certain ways and connect my exterior antenna, like the antenna hang out the window or position in a certain place, and it picks up its channels. And now you don't get what the cable gives you, where they tell you what show you're watching and all that type of information for the most part.
Right.
It just gives you very, very little. But but you can pick up all different types of shows and things. And some days it's better than other days. Sort of like with the satellite dish, you know. Mm-hmm. But the point is that the TV picks up channels and stations. A lot of people don't even know their TVs do that. And that's just with a regular $20, $30, whatever, maybe less. I never had one less, but $30 antenna, exterior antenna. So my question, to relate back to what I was saying before, mm-hmm. let's say I have this hooked up that way, not a cable box, and I'm just pulling channels with the antenna, mm-hmm. but yet it is a smart TV. If, however, I'm watching channels through that and not using my Wi-Fi,
right.
then that would be the same as where you said it's offline right now.
Right.
So that would disengage that capability. Am I correct?
Or yeah, I would say offline? that's correct. If you don't give your television a way to send stuff over the internet, it won't be able to send stuff over the internet. So, if you're that concerned about your privacy and you still want to buy a TV, then yeah, that's what you would have to ask. Will this work offline? Will it still let me watch things or play my game console on it or whatever it is you want to do without trading off the whatever data might be sent about you over the internet? And as more and more television happens now over the internet, and more and more of the award shows are being taken up by productions by online entities rather than television broadcasters or cable channels or anything like that, this is the direction things are moving, and it behooves us to be aware of this and really consider the choices we're making when we decide as a society that this is okay for my television to do, this is okay for my phone to do, this is okay for my console.
Then that's the case, right?
I'm sorry?
I mean, our laptops and our phones do it too then, if that's the case you're saying.
In as much as we can still control any of that. But this has been interesting. Thank you very much for your call.
And, all right, thank you. I appreciate the time.
Thank you.
I appreciate y'all. And thanks, I'm always watching your show and I tell people about it too, so you do great work. I really appreciate it.
Excellent. We appreciate you.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
And with that, we're just about out of time. But I would remind everyone to get in touch with us any way you can. OTH@2600.com or tweet at us at Hacker Radio Show. Let us know what's going on in the world, things that interest you in your work that you might be doing in your spheres of experience. We want to hear about it. OTH@2600.com, Hacker Radio Show on Twitter. Ask us questions, make comments, do the stuff that you do, and keep being awesome. For Off the Hook, for our absent friends Emmanuel and Kyle, still flitting about Europe somewhere. For everyone else, thank you to our guest Trey Forgetty, and thank you to all of you out there. For Off the Hook, have a very good night.
name is Dan Ingram, and I'm a WBAI fan. They've always been, you know, the station that kicked butt and the station that said what you're not supposed to say because the people in power don't want to hear it, and I love that.
I have to celebrate you, baby.
Today is January the 17th, 2018. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the program is available on wbai.org/archive. It's also available on prn.fm and on our website pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio and PRN.FM on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive, the programs are different. You know, recently I had a problem, and I figure that, what, it's the beginning of the year, I might as well get that patch in that Microsoft was putting out on Meltdown and just get it updated on my Windows 10. Well, I had it updated and my system locked out. Unlike the way it's been reported in the press, it does not brick the system, but the lockdown means that I was unable to boot the system properly. I did a little research on it, and it turns out that the Meltdown patch that Microsoft put out had been attributed to antivirus. Well, I'm not running any antivirus programs other than Defender from Microsoft, so what could the problem be? Well, it turns out that the headline news by the mainstream media and the mainstream computer journals kind of didn't quite get it right. It had to do with anti-malware software. I had a program installed to detect rootkit malware, and that, in effect, was interfering with a patch. So I decided that I would just go back to a point where I did not have a problem. Now, to do that, I have to boot up the system and bring it to a restore condition, or the last point that I had, a last good point of restore. It's easier said than done. If you can't boot up the system, how do you do it? Well, there's a couple ways of doing it. It turns out that one of the ways of doing it is that you can bring up the system and go into a recovery stage. The recovery stage says, I want to be able to reinstall the operating system. However, there are options in reinstalling the operating system in which you can bring it to factory fresh condition where there's nothing else on it other than what was sold to you on the machine. The other option you have is you bring it to the original operating system state, but it leaves the file, your data files intact. The third is you have the option of recovering the system to your last restore point, and that was exactly what I did. So anyone who has this problem, just remember that's the way to do it. And the only thing I can say about this is I would just hold off on these patches until they get it right. Unless you really have an urgent need to install the Meltdown patch, hold off on it. The U.S. Supreme Court will revisit a ruling on the collection of internet sales tax. A South Dakota law is making the Supreme Court reconsider a 1992 ruling that you can only apply sales tax if they are physically located in the state. The United States Supreme Court has agreed to hear the state of South Dakota's argument that a 26-year-old tax-related ruling should be overturned, which could free state and local governments to collect billions in internet sales tax. The 1992 ruling was Quill versus North Dakota, center on a mail-order business, and it inadvertently set a far-reaching precedent for e-commerce companies by only allowing states to collect sales tax from businesses with a quote-unquote physical presence in a given state. Critics of the ruling have long decried the clause by saying it makes no sense in the age of Amazon and internet e-commerce, and that it disadvantages existing brick-and-mortar retailers and state and local governments. South Dakota passed a law 2 years ago with the intention of overturning the ruling by demanding that retailers with more than $100,000 in annual sales pay a 4.5% sales tax on all sales. The state government then filed suit to have the case heard by the higher courts in an effort to get the measure deemed constitutional. South Dakota argued in its appeal to the Supreme Court, which this week agreed to take up the case. The Supreme Court's decision, which is not expected until sometime later on, has major implications on online businesses and prominent e-commerce companies like furniture seller Wayfair and consumer electronics seller like Newegg, which collect sales tax in only certain states, have expressed opposition to having the ruling overturned, as it would increase prices and remove any advantage they had over physical retailers. Amazon, which long ago decided to start collecting sales tax when it started building fulfillment centers around the country, will also be affected. That's because third-party sellers on Amazon are responsible for collecting the sales tax, and they don't necessarily follow through to record it and properly process it to the respective states and city governments. There's now news that the market has started to lose some steam and prices of high-end flash memory chips, which are widely used in smartphones, have dropped about 5% in the fourth quarter. The $122 billion memory chip industry has enjoyed actually a very unprecedented boom since the mid-2016, expanding nearly 70% in 2017 alone, thanks to robust growth of smartphones and cloud services that requires more powerful chips that can store more data. Memory chips will likely see a gradual price decline now in 2018. Last year's explosive growth gave chip makers cash to reinvest and boost their output production. Analysts said that this supply of NAND flash memory chips in particular will grow 43% this year, up from last year's 34%, but that will cause prices to drop by about 10%. Like everything else in a free market, it's the law of supply and demand. If there's an oversupply, prices come down. If they make adjustments to lower the supply, prices will go up. Last month, during the Christmas shopping season, there were many big sales. It was a very successful selling period for American retailers. And then I see this headline that says, U.S. shoppers abandoned PC makers in hour of need. And that was a Gartner report. And I said, wait a minute, there's something wrong with that. What Gartner said was that American PC market in the fourth quarter and the rest of the world caught a cold. Global sales declined. And this does not match up with the numbers I've been seeing. And then sometimes you have to look at it in greater detail. They said the U.S. saw a steep decline, which offset the generally positive results in other regions. Four of the top five vendors in the U.S. reported declines. Wait a minute now. They all had great sales. Where did this decline come from? They said that on the global stage, Lenovo remained on HP's coattail in second spot by a percentage point. I thought it was a lot more than that. For the year, they said that the PC shipments fell 2.8%, and this doesn't jive. Then, a week after that, another sales study came out from IDC, and IDC said, wow, sales grew for the first time since 2011. HP led the pack, followed by Lenovo and Dell. The market for PC grew during the holiday season last year, which is a first in 6 years of declining demand for computers. And according to this IDC report, which includes desktops, notebooks, and workstations, grew a little bit under 1% over the holiday season. IDC had initially predicted a demand would decline by 1.7%. In first place, of course, is HP, with 22.7% of the market, followed by Lenovo in the teens. Lenovo came in second place, and they were overtaken by HP for the first time in 4 years. The company underwent a restructuring last year as an attempt to reclaim domestic markets. I'm talking about HP now. And it performed well, especially outside the United States with its notebooks. And then you look at it more carefully and say, wait a minute now, these numbers don't match up. And like anything else, the news is, it depends on who writes the news and how you interpret the news. It turns out that Gartner does not include Chromebooks, and they only look at the number of units shipped to channel outlets. In other words, channel outlet would be Newegg, Best Buy, you know, people that will then resell the equipment. And now, wait a minute now. So how is IDC any different? I see IDC is different in that they included Chromebooks. And that was a biggie. And another thing is that in this world of e-commerce now, hey, you know what? I've been buying equipment directly from HP, Dell, and Lenovo, and that doesn't get recorded as a channel sale. So you got to read this very carefully. And I just feel that the PC market is quite healthy, as evidenced by the earnings reported by HP in terms of their computer division. It's everyone had given up for dead, and the guy has done a fantastic job. When they split up the company, they split it up as HP computers and printers, and it's a dying industry, and they took the software part and system part and called HP Enterprise. Guess which one is coming out the better? The computers. It's still the world of computers. We have a couple interesting segments this evening. The first will be Dr. Alfred Paul with a recap of CES. That's a computer electronics show. This will be followed by Marty Winston with his, what he calls, the buses waiting, which is really the I.O. channels. And we have decided that CES is such a major show that we will broadcast a segment from Dr. Alfred Paul from last week in which he met with corporate executives.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
Well, I'm back from CES in Las Vegas, and it looks like I've survived another one. Saw a lot of interesting things. I probably met with